Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Hey, hello everybody. One of the wonderful things I enjoy so much about my relationship and friendship with Ajahn Poonadamo is when he recommends a book to me and I read it, it always ends up being a superb book. It's just, he's got great, great taste in books. And last time I was here, about 7 years ago, he recommended a great book for me called Gem in the Lotus by Abraham Arely. That was a book I'd recommend to anybody else as well. It's got like an Indologist, a Western Indologist, investigates the history of India before, during, and after the time of the Buddha, and provides a lot more context as to what the culture and lifestyle was like, which goes beyond what you're going to read if you just read the Pali Canon. It provides more background information. You can understand some of the motivations of the Buddha a little bit better, what he was dealing with in that culture. The views of the Brahmins, the behaviors, the things that they would do, the kind of racket they ran. That was super entertaining. And another great book he recommended for me, Ajahn Poonadamo, was he mentioned this book called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. And, at first was not super keen to go read it, but then Sam Harris did a podcast with Ian McGilchrist where they discussed the book, and I listened to it, and yeah, I was just so impressed, by what they talked about, and so I made an effort to get this book, and I finally got my hands on it, and I've read about half of it now, and yeah, what a great book, and it very much touches upon a lot of themes that Buddhism covers. So Ian McGilchrist, he's not any Buddhist, but he's a neuroscientist, and he discusses a lot of the patterns and generalizations that can be explained about how the left and the right hemisphere of the brain work. By the way, a little aside, there's a great video on TED.com by Jill Bolte Taylor called My Stroke of Genius, or My Stroke of Insight, I think it's called. My Stroke of Insight. She too is a brain scientist, and she suffered a stroke in her left hemisphere of her brain, and then tells the story of what it was like when only her right hemisphere worked for a while, which was radically different. And it was very spiritual. She had this really deeply spiritual experience until, her left hemisphere was revived and her life was saved through a surgery which got this blood clot out of her inside of her skull. Anyway, that's a really good video for anyone who hasn't seen it. But I had just recently become a Buddhist monk when that made the rounds. Everyone was talking about it, and that got me thinking about, kind of the left and the right hemisphere quite a bit, and what the differences were there in kind of like what the mind is like, what one's personality is like, even when one is a more left-brained person or a more right-brained person. And one of the kind of heavy things that Ian McGilchrist says, he says a bunch of super heavy things. There's no way I'll even be able to mention even a quarter of them during this Dhamma talk, not even a tenth. Like a lot of stuff, you got to pause because he hits you with a ton of bricks. But one of the big ones is the way the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere work are so different. They can be so different. It is as though you've got two different personalities. Like when you're in a left-brained way, your personality will exhibit certain characteristics, certain patterned, predictable characteristics. And then when you get into a more right hemisphere way of thinking, way of being, your personality will be so different in that mode. It is as though you have a second personality. And again, there are patterns, characteristics, which are predictable that you're going to find there. And Buddhism through and through teaches us to go on over to that right hemisphere. Even though, of course, back at the time of the Buddha, they had a very dim understanding of how the brain worked, obviously, the science they had back then. Early lists of the 32 parts of the body don't even include a brain, although later on the brain does get included. I was reading the Kudakapata, and the brain's in there. It's the last thing in the list, and there's a footnote. Tanisro says, in an earlier recounting of this, the brain doesn't even make it into the list. Anyway, it's forgivable. That's where their science was at. I don't hold that against them. And it's wonderful how the Buddha kind of beat the brain scientists to all of this wonderful wisdom and wonderful teachings and kind of advice, which very much, shall we say, optimizes on like get the most out of that right hemisphere of yours. There's so much waiting there for you, which will improve your life. And okay, like I don't claim to have a perfect list in my mind of all those benefits, okay, but I'll try to recount several of those benefits as Ian McGilchrist recounts it. Number one, empathy. If we live in a very logical, rational, heavily fact-based kind of life, very left hemisphere, very calculating, very fact-based, detail-based, sure, we will have some regard for the emotions of other people. We will have a, shall we say, kind of a half, kind of a half accurate, slightly hazy regard for others' emotions. It's not like we don't care at all. But over in the right hemisphere is where empathy is. That's where you're going to have things like compassion. Interestingly, one of the functions that the right hemisphere does very well, it looks at people's faces in their completeness. It sees their whole facial expression, including their eyes, all the micro expressions around the eyes, the little tiny, hints and clues, even in micro expressions around the eyes and stuff. When we're in a left hemisphere mode, we don't even look at people's faces entirely. We'll only look at the bottom half of their face in the left hemisphere mode. We'll just look at whether they're smiling or frowning, basically, which is a real quick measure of are they happy or unhappy. A smile or a frown can tell us that real quick. But we won't get a high resolution look at their whole face. What's it saying? What nuanced emotion is there for us to see? What clues, what messages? That's very right hemisphere. The left hemisphere just gets that quick look at the lower half of the face. The right hemisphere looks at the whole thing. Yeah, so empathy, huge one. If we want to get into these Brahmaviharas, we want to get into the jhanas, we are going to need that increased emotional maturity, increased emotional depth, which the right hemisphere is so good at, but the left is not. Another great thing the right hemisphere of the brain does is its use of language, speech. It may not have quite as elaborate a vocabulary as what the left hemisphere can command. When you speak from your left hemisphere, you have a very, broad and deep command of language, like a big vocabulary, and you can address deep, intricate intellectual things. The right hemisphere, you speak much more simply. You have some vocabulary. However, your voice will be imbued with much more emotional tone. Your voice will have what is called prosody, meaning the intonation of your voice is done more carefully. That is a right hemisphere function. You will speak with much more emotional appropriateness and emotional, like, measuredness. And what else the right hemisphere does is called modulation, meaning it adds restrainedness and, like, pausedness, like, slowing downness to how much we say or how fast we say it. It makes us choose our words a lot more carefully, which is right speech up and down, you know, the way Buddhism describes right speech. If you don't get good at right hemisphere, if one does not get good at right hemisphere kind of dwelling, to fulfill right speech is going to be virtually impossible, in my opinion. The prasadi is not going to be there. The modulation is not going to be there. Or it is highly unlikely, anyways, to be there. Like, as Ian McGilchrist mentions all this right brain stuff, I'm like, ah, John Shaw's a master of that. Ah, John Shaw's a master of that. And he's a master of that. And a master of that, too. And a master of that, too. He speaks in a much more simple language, but he speaks to your heart. You know, that's what he was so darn good at. That's one of the big reasons everyone loved him so much. He wasn't any high-fluting intellectual, but he was such a people person. He was so great at reading people. He was so great at quickly understanding people's nature and then connecting with them. He was so good at that. Very right hemisphere. Another highly interesting talent the right hemisphere has is when you dwell that way, when you get good at staying in that mode, you have those eureka moments a lot more. That's a function of the right hemisphere. Meaning, like, you weren't aiming to solve some sort of a problem. You weren't actively thinking about it, actively trying to find a solution, but you just have a eureka moment where the answer dawns on you. That it is by getting good at being in the right hemisphere that you have more of those eureka moments, way more. And I would say that the life of a forest-dwelling monk kind of forces you to get, you need that eureka goodness on your side if you are to enjoy this life. In the last year, year and a half, I have been staying in some different Buddhist monasteries or even just viharas, meaning a place where Buddhist monks can stay, but it's not a monastery, but you can still hold your vinaya there. It's a little more convenient to lifestyle. There's things like hot showers, you know, there's electricity in every bedroom or every room or whatever, you know, it's almost like luxurious, you know, ooh, electricity, you know, there's like a washer and dryer, you know what I mean? Like, you don't take that stuff for granted when you live out in the forest and you have to wash your clothes yourself, etc. But what I love about being out here, you know, this isn't complaining at all about this life as a forest monk. I feel it is great because you're going to have to get that eureka goodness going on, or your life is going to be far more frustrating and far more unpleasant. Like, basically, every time I walk between my kuti and here, the sala, without fail, I have to remember like three, four, or five things that I need. Like, oh, I need a refill of my coffee, or oh, I got to pick up a book from the library, or drop a book off, or I got to remember to ask this person about this thing, and you know what I mean? Like, and I need that eureka thing going on to remember that all, eh? Like, I just sit in my kuti and I have no agenda at all. Like, I mean none. Like, all my basics have been addressed. You know, I've managed to wash my face. I've managed to put on clothes. I've managed to start a fire if necessary. This sort of thing. Drink a cup of coffee. I kind of got all my basics together. And then the agenda is now do nothing. You know, nothing. And while I'm sitting there, I might read some suttas, but not all that much. Maybe 20 minutes a day. There's kind of a whole lot of nothing I do every day. But that nothing is not unproductive because I'm trying to remain mindful that whole time. And I'm trying to appreciate the Buddha's teachings, even though I might not be in formal meditation, but I'm still trying to keep an object of meditation alive. Okay? And then I have these eureka moments. Oh, you know, I wonder if that bike will come tonight. And by the way, it did, you know? That just occurred to me. Or yeah, like just remember what I need to do. Oh, I gotta check that water level on the tank building here, the water tank building. I can't let that get too low. You know what I mean? Without those eureka things occurring to me, like that tank might just drain dry, and then no one can fill their water bottles or their pails or whatever, and it's treated water, you know, it's been filtered. And that's a duty I have, you know, I have to remember these things. Like, oh, I'm gonna need a flashlight. Okay, I'll put the flashlight into my little shoulder pouch. Okay, you know what I mean? And then when I come here, I have all the right objects that I need. Seriously, I have like five or six of these Eurekas like every day. I have to. Or else I'll go to some building and, oh, I needed that flashlight. No, like it's, oh, now it's way back in my cootie. You know, oh no, is there time to go back? Okay, you know, like, you know, then your life is not pleasant anymore. It's like, uh-oh, now there's stress. There's, geez, I'm supposed to be an odd John. I'm not supposed to. I need to, you know, I got to show a demeanor of being, you know, collected, and you know, geez, I can't let that stress show, you know, and you know, but like, but if my eureka thing was working earlier on, then it's that much easier. Or even just being aware of the time, you know, like, oh yeah, I should go in 5 or 10 minutes and try to budget a little extra time, because of course there's always little complications or unexpected things or whatever. You know, just time management even. It's like, yeah, I'll give myself this much time, not rush, and just kind of moving through the day in a relatively graceful way takes like tremendous mindfulness when compared to my life, let's say, in a more city dwelling, where you just don't have to think of all this stuff. You know, everything's convenient. For the first several weeks here, I had to bring a couple of water bottles with me, like metal drinking water bottles, and even just to keep enough water in my cootie so I didn't run out of drinking water. Like, you never think about this when you live in the city. It's like, I don't need a water bottle. I just go to the kitchen sink, you know, whatever. I get a glass out of the cupboard and everything's right there. So this the monastic lifestyle, how can I put this? There are a whole bunch of ways I now appreciate how those who don't really make an effort to get over to that right hemisphere and develop it, you know, kind of like bring that skill area up, if you know what I mean. It's as though you rubbed a cat's fur the wrong way. You know what I mean? You'll be at odds with the flow of the culture. By the way, when I came to the monastery, I was an extremely left-brain person, okay? Like, I'll plead guilty here. You know, if anyone is feeling, oh man, I feel kind of, you know, I feel bad because I, you know, yeah, I know I should be more right-brain, but I just don't. And, you know, don't feel bad, okay, if you're hearing this. We all start somewhere. I was super duper left brain when I came to the monastery, okay? I come from this like hardcore science background where everything is very abstract, extremely abstract and super duper brainy. By the way, the left hemisphere does a great job of that. It thinks in the abstract. The right hemisphere does not. The right hemisphere is very much about what is happening here and now, nothing in the abstract. Which, by the way, smacks of mindfulness. It's all about mindfulness. Yeah, I'm going to read you a couple little quotations from the book that I brought. The right hemisphere deals preferentially with actually existing things as they are encountered in the real world. The right hemisphere is the locus of interpretation. Not only of facial expression, but of prosody, vocal intonation, and gesture. So the right hemisphere is great when not all the facts are there. You know, things are a little bit perhaps vague or a little bit like undefined, or people are using indirect speech with you, or they're just not giving you as many details and facts as you would like. The right hemisphere is okay with that. It can deal with that indefiniteness. The left hemisphere doesn't like that. The left hemisphere wants details. It wants everything nailed down. It wants everything reduced to like clean-cut rules. And if there's anything vaguely defined, no, it wants it nailed down. It wants details. And the weird thing about the left hemisphere, even if perhaps there are no details available that you would like to get, it will be content with even made up details. Okay, the details don't even necessarily need to be true. They just need to be details. So it'll look for details even when they don't exist, okay? It can even make up details itself and then kind of like satisfy itself that, yeah, now it has some details. But those made up details don't hold to be true later on when kind of cross-examined. Like the left hemisphere can be a BSer. It can make up rationalizations for things even when they don't hold to be true, which is really interesting. Okay, now it gave me an insight that a lot of the teachings of the Buddha, he talks a lot about patterns. He talks a lot about generalizations. A lot of his suttas actually don't have a really crisp level of detail. He will give a generalization when he can, when it's true enough, you know? He will explain any pattern he can to help you attain Nibbana. But sometimes there is a little bit of, you might say, gray area in certain teachings, certain aspects of human nature. When there's a bit of grayness to it, when there's a bit of indefiniteness to it, what I appreciate about the Buddha is he is careful to not go making claims about details when it would be to go too far. Okay? It's just a generalization. There will be small exceptions here and there to the generalizations. If you really press the issue, sure, there's going to be little exceptions, you know, extenuating circumstances. But he can give you the generalization in just a paragraph or two, and it by and large holds true, you know? And how can I put this? It seems to me that a lot of the later Buddhist texts, they seem to be very eager to run up and provide a bunch of extra details in that left-brained way. You know, they're like, well, the Buddha never nailed this stuff down, but we'll do that for you. And okay, sometimes I feel those are well justified and helpful. Although there are also some, I think, fairly well documented cases where the commentaries and later works, they will go out on a limb a little too far, giving details when maybe they shouldn't have quite been so risk-taking, and they are then shown up to be inconsistent somehow. They are shown up to be inaccurate. You know, new evidence might come to the table centuries later, which is like, well, with their knowledge they had at the time, that was a believable explanation. But by today's understanding of, you know, physics or astrophysics or biology or whatever, sorry, that's just sort of maybe a helpful allegory at best. I'm afraid we're going to have to let go of that as being a literal truth. Yeah. So there is this aspect of human nature when one is left hemisphered that, like, details, you know, you must have them even at the cost of truth sometimes. You know what I mean? That's one of the flaws of the left hemisphere. Another flaw the left hemisphere has is someone who is that way too much. Well, there are several disadvantages to it. One is that it's easy to get stuck in left hemisphere mode. There's a stickiness to it. Like the more one uses it, the more the one stays that way and conditions that way of thinking. There's sort of a stickiness where you almost can't get out of it. You're almost, how can I put this? One is challenged to go over to the right hemisphere. It's hard to do. You know, like it sort of begets more left hemisphere-ness the more you use it. Not so with the right hemisphere. It is very graceful in its movement over to the left hemisphere when it's necessary. Another disadvantage of the left hemisphere is it can overestimate its abilities. It can fall into like hubris too easily and be sort of blind to its own flaws, you know, forget about what its weaknesses are. It's a little too bold. Whereas the right hemisphere has a more balanced sense of like, well, yeah, I might have some strengths, but also some weaknesses too. And, you know, I should not make myself out to know more than I really know, or I shouldn't toot my own horn when I still have work to do, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. By the way, once in a while, I like to read, rarely, this is very rare, classical Taoism, the earlier books of Taoism, once in a while have some very Buddhist compatible teachings in there. And a really good book, which I read since I was here last, and I highly recommend, is it's called The Way of Chuang Tzu. Chuang Tzu, like Chuang space T apostrophe Zu. And he's kind of like the number two founding father of Taoism. Lao Tzu is being kind of the number one founding father, who is famous for the Tao Te Ching. One of the kind of little mini teachings, almost you could say a sutta in the Way of Chuang Tzu, is called Chui the Draftsman. And Chui is a name of a person, like C-H apostrophe U-I. So one of these Taoist disciples was named Chui, and back in his lay life, he was a draftsman, like basically an architect. And he would draft up architectural drawings, like he would draw blueprints. And he was so good at that job, he was so very talented, he didn't even need a ruler or a compass. With his free hand, he could just draw things like arrow straight. His drawing ability was just superb. He could draw a circle freehand just like it was drawn with a compass. Like he could just draw a perfect circle. And what this teaching is about is how when he does his craft, he does it so effortlessly that he doesn't even have to think about it. It just flows. He doesn't have to bog down in any details. He just knows how to do it. He's an expert. And when you enter into a holy life, if you bring knowledge of that kind with you, very left brain knowledge, but you've gotten so good at it that it's automatic, like this Chui the Draftsman, okay, fine. It is okay at the right times to do that, you know, for the sake of your religion or your fellow brothers and sisters, because this will not detract from your spiritual life. It is just like wearing shoes that fit your feet so well that they don't pinch your feet and they just disappear. You don't even know the shoes are there. It's only when the shoe pinches that you know the shoe is there. Okay, but if the shoe doesn't pinch, it just disappears from your mind. It just, you don't think about it. Or if your belt isn't too tight, well, you just don't even think about it. It disappears. So just in the same way, I think the takeaway lesson here is that of... when we live our holy life, sometimes we do have to do left brain type things, okay? Let's say, just as a John Punadam was saying, putting the lawnmower attachment onto the tractor. You know, hey, I appreciate he does that. And that's all well and good. And that takes technical skill. But hopefully it only takes him an hour or two, and then he can go right back to being a monk again, you know? This isn't something that bogs him down. He doesn't lay awake at night thinking of the tractor. You know, he doesn't, hopefully, I'm pretty sure he doesn't lay awake at night like, oh man, that, you know. Yeah, like a little bit of left brain type stuff in the holy life is going to be necessary. Taking care of the duties that are necessary. And by the way, let me just make clear that I don't recommend that we completely do away with left brain thinking. It is super helpful and necessary in our lives. But it is a question of how often and how much we use it. And if we were wise, what our default would be the right hemisphere way of being. But you just dip into the left hemisphere when you need it, and only as much as you need it, so that you can go back to the right hemisphere and dwell there as much as possible. So, yes, as we do our duties, and some of them are left hemisphere, well and good. But it's the stuff that really occupies our mind a lot, really gets in our minds, that can be a spiritual vexation. And I speak making this mistake a lot when I was a junior monk, by the way. I really got involved in my earlier junior days. Like, I did a lot of website work for several monasteries. I posted a whole bunch of Dhamma talks on the web, thousands of Dhamma talks. It took like hundreds of hours of serious computer stuff to do that, Yeah, and anyone who does that work, by the way, I call that merit. That is meritorious and that is praiseworthy, okay? So I just want to acknowledge Dantika here, who's doing wonderful work doing video Dhamma talks of Ajahn Poonardamo's teachings. And she has all kinds of great pictures and artwork, and there's a lot of art to that and science. And it's hard to do, by the way. I will praise her for this non-trivial skill that a lot of people do not have, okay? I will praise her for that. Nonetheless, if I'm going to represent the Buddhist teachings, I do have to just say, it can become a spiritual vexation very easily if we get stuck in that left hemisphere mode. Can we turn it off at the end of the day? Can we get a good night's rest every night? Because we didn't overuse that ability. So there's a balance to be struck where we don't overuse this stuff. Please continue making the videos. I say awesome. But pacing ourselves, that is a big skill in holy life. Pacing ourselves so that we don't get lost in that kind of thing. It's a crucial spiritual skill. Crucial. And I was terrible at it in my earlier days as a monk. Just terrible. I think I was quite a vexation to Ajahn Sona, my teacher, because he's trying to teach me all this Buddhist stuff, and I'm all. Every time I'd open my mouth, computer language would come out of my mouth about how I was working on this or that thing for the Dhamma talks and, the website and the computers in the office and, But the language he was needing to come out of my mouth needed to sound like a Buddhist monk. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think I've gotten much better at that now. And I try to take that Chewy the Draftsman kind of view to it now, where I still use computers. I have not completely just thrown them all in the garbage and renounced them 100%. But when I do use them, I want to use them only in ways that I already understand, skills I've already well developed in the past, where I don't have to like hit my left hemisphere hard at all. Like, if I'm just typing a letter to a friend or something, like over the years, my typing, for example, has gotten so experienced, so, well conditioned. I don't even think of what keys I'm pressing anymore. Like, I don't look at the keyboard. I just put my hands on the keyboard and just kind of flutter my fingertips, and then the words come out. You know what I mean? That's the kind of thing I'm talking about, where you don't have to think, you just know it. You just, yeah. So all of the things I do still do on a computer. Are those easier things? Are those like pretty much automatic things? It's not hard for me. It's kind of like muscle memory kind of stuff, you know? Yeah, and like I do meet, by the way, from time to time, different Buddhist monks, and they're all excited, like, oh, let's write some software to help us study the Pali Canon, Pali study software. We'll have all kinds of fancy ways of processing it and organizing it, and there are several efforts I could tell you a lot more about, but I won't in this talk. Several efforts underway to make like really modern, really impressive software for modern Pali scholars. Like, this is going to be tremendously helpful to those sorts of scholars. And they're like, yeah, Venerable Super, like, you should use your programming skills. I'm like, no. Oh, I learned the hard way. I really don't want to go down that road of like any programming, any software programming. That's going to be Exactly the kind of left brain stuckness. Once you get thinking in that way, it's so hard to stop solving that next problem, you know, that kind of thing. If only I had this, if only I did that. Oh, I gotta check that tomorrow, whatever, you know, like, yeah, like that'll just plague me. Okay. Now, another neat thing I'll mention from this master and his emissary. Here's an interesting difference between the right hemisphere and left hemisphere. According to the right hemisphere, truth is only ever provisional. But that does not mean that one must give up the quest or hope of truth itself. Okay, so the left hemisphere is very concerned about factual truth and very like precise truth. It needs fixity, divorced from the present moment, need not have anything to do with the present moment or the present place you are. The right hemisphere has its own sort of kind of truth. And it is a provisional truth, meaning like what is true has the context of this place and time, and has the context of, you know, these particular people who are here, this particular situation. What is appropriate here and now in this social situation? What are the kind of the agreed upon sort of views we have? The right hemisphere takes that all into account. It has this circumspect kind of like all calculating, instant arrival at that which is appropriate, that which is true, that which is correct, and it's provisional. It's contextual. If I go and visit my family back in Saskatchewan, who aren't really Buddhists, well, they have their own truth, you might say, when I'm there with them. You know what I mean? For them, their big truth, you might say, is that of the family, family togetherness. What sorts of things do families like to do? That's what they want to do. I can't have any real deep spiritual conversation with them, or at least I can't assume they're ready to have such a conversation. Such conversations perhaps might happen out on a walk together or something, but it sure isn't the default. You know, for them, it's just like, well, what's the next meal going to be? What nice thing can we eat? Or what should we do? What should we? And, you know, it's just simple things. Look at pictures of babies and stuff, you know, look at, which is fine. You know, it's like kind of a family sort of truth, you know, and it has to do with that context. So the right brain is fantastic at taking all that into account, knowing the context. And when the brain scientists watch this thinking occur with their like fMRIs or whatever, you know, the brain just lights up like a Christmas tree as all these messages are passed around. A whole bunch of areas of the brain all work in a symphony to arrive at that contextual truth, that kind of socially correct truth. The right hemisphere is characterized as being like very networky, a lot of message passing, a lot of talking back and forth, different parts of the brain. Whereas the left hemisphere has these areas that do like heavy processing, and they're very localized, not a lot of message passing. Like they just crunch hard. They're almost like the CPU of a computer. You know, the left hemisphere is way more like crunch power, and it's just local spots. Very interesting. Okay. Anyway, interestingly, traditional culture, like medieval sort of culture, or even earlier forms of culture, basically most of human history, if you just exclude these recent few centuries, several centuries in the Western world, the lifestyle is very interestingly much more balanced with the left and right hemisphere. And I think, you know, traditional ethnic Asian culture, there are aspects about it which we might do well to appreciate as Westerners, which have more of a left and right hemisphere balanced way of thinking and being and living. They're much more family oriented. They're much more empathetic to each other, aware of each other's emotions. they have much more what is called theory of mind, meaning like you consider what the other people might be thinking or the other person might be thinking, like what's probably in their head. Or you consider how will they probably react if I say this thing? You know, you kind of think a step ahead as to how they will probably react before you might say anything. Yeah, whenever I've been in a, you know, an ethnic Asian milieu, they're really good at that. Far better than I am. They are extremely careful about what they utter because they've already thought ahead as to what your reaction will be. They're silent a lot more. They don't want to utter something which would elicit a reaction which isn't what they want. Even though those earlier human cultures, kind of before modern times, even though they were characterized by a lot less, let's say, convenience, a lot less science, their lifespans were shorter, you know, there's a lot of negatives. It's not, you know, I don't have to tell you them all, but the medicine wasn't as good, etc. There was a number of disadvantages, but one of the big benefits that I think they enjoyed that we're sort of starting to lose now in the West, our modern times, one of the big benefits they'd enjoyed is that as the generations proceeded through time, generations of people, families, when you're living in a fairly low-tech way and nothing really changes very much, the technology doesn't improve very much at all, you might be doing the exact same thing that your parents' generation did. And your parents did the exact same thing that your grandparents' generation did. And so on and so forth. Like you know, if you look back through the generations, they're using the same technologies for like centuries and centuries, maybe even millennia. You know, they're maybe cooking over the very same fire made out of wood collected from the forest, branch wood, you know? They're cooking over a wood fire. Or like maybe the way that they make homemade cloth on a loom, or the way that they dye it with natural dyes from certain roots, or you know what I mean? Or knowledge of whatever herbs are in the forest that you can just eat, having some medicinal qualities, or just when that technology changes very little, it affords you a lifestyle where you can be in the right hemisphere a lot more. You're not stuck on the technology all the time. As you are raised up in that culture, your father or your grandfather or whatever teaches you what you need to know. Okay, here's how you, let's say, shoot a rabbit with a bow and arrow. Okay, that's how you've been shooting rabbits for millennia. Like that's ever since the bow and arrow was invented. This is how you shoot some supper. You know what I mean? By the way, Buddhism does not praise the killing of animals, but I'm just giving you an example of technology. Maybe that's not a great example here, but you know what I mean? When the technology changes very little, you are afforded far more of a right brain lifestyle because you don't, you know, you just don't dwell on that technology. It's simple. Like lighting a fire does not take all that big of an IQ. You know what I mean? You know, shooting an arrow at a rabbit does not take that much of an IQ. Maybe some practice, but even less intelligently gifted people can still shoot a bow and arrow. You know what I mean? They just practice. A lot of this older technology, you don't need to be smart to use it. You know, your left hemisphere doesn't need to be all that powerful at all. And you know, while you're building the fire, you can be socializing with your family. It's so easy to do. You know, you can be empathizing with them in your right hemisphere. You know, you can be using great prosody and modulation in your voice and laughing and singing songs, in fact, as you do your work. You know, the right hemisphere is all about music. You know, when you know, some of these traditional ethnic Asian cultures, you know, like they have a song they sing when they plant the rice. They all sing together. You know, there's all these customs and traditions that are like different songs for different work they do, and they all sing together, and it's a group thing, and you're part of the group. You know, that's very right hemisphere, and they're happy. They enjoy the work. You know, yeah, the jobs I used to have, oh, they weren't like that at all. There was no singing during the work. It was characterized by high stress and very left hemisphere. And yeah. The pay was good, but man, was that took a toll on my on my spiritual life. It was very vexing, you know. I had to pay for it, even though the paycheck was good. In a sense, there was damage I had to take in my emotional life, in my psychological happiness. You know what I mean? That paycheck did not come without an offsetting cost, which almost didn't make it worth it, you know? And yeah, now that the younger generation, we're all aware of how much they love to use their smartphones and iPads and stuff. How right hemisphered are those kids going to be? That's something scary to contemplate. By the way, another talent of the right hemisphere is feeling a sense of the space around you, feeling the spaciousness, feeling connected with the place you're in, and sort of like wide open and, you know, part of the physical space you're in. And by the way, many Buddhist teachings, many suttas hint at this is what we're going for eventually as we progress in our practice. Like a mind that is free of boundaries, free of limitations, wide open, limitless. That's very right brain language. That's where you want to go. But if we keep hammering our left hemispheres all the time, good luck developing that kind of a mind. I think technology does have a place in our life, but we need to get to the Chewy the draftsman way of using it, where we just do the things we need to do. And note I said need, okay? And we make a careful delineation between need and want. If we do all the things we want to do on computers, well, we'll be there all day long. Using that left hemisphere way too much. So, you know, Buddhism has something powerful to teach about discerning between needs and wants. Teachings around contentment, you know, fewness of wishes. This has everything to do with learning how to use this technology when we need to, not just because we want to. And when we use it in the ways we need to, can we do it, how can I put this, as much as possible, favoring doing the things we already know how to do, you know, things that are familiar, things that are just naturally aren't a problem for us. Now I understand why it's so hard to teach my parents any new skills on a computer. You know what I mean? Then they have to leave that Chewy the draftsman easy use of it. Yeah. Like when smartphones came out, I resisted it for a long time, as long as I could, actually. I was one of the biggest heel draggers of getting a smartphone of anyone I know. And now I think there was a bit of an innate wisdom there that I can now put my finger on. It was because when using a laptop, that was where my Chewy the draftsman knowledge more so was. To me, to use a mouse and just a keyboard and to me, that was easier, more natural. It didn't hammer my left hemisphere any more than necessary. Didn't have to learn any new system, you know? A whole new ecosystem of apps, a whole new operating system, a whole new kind of a world, you know, where there's kind of some different common sense applies that you have to learn over a period of a year or two. Something like that. Despite everyone's claims, oh, it's so easy, it's so easy. No, there is something to it, to learning how to use it smartly, wisely, appropriately, learning about the necessary parts, the unnecessary parts, how to use it in a way where it doesn't take your life over. That takes finesse. That takes time. Because it will take your life over. Yeah. I would say my biggest vexation is like here's a little example. The last place I was just staying in Calgary, I had this weather checking app on my smartphone. I just want to see what the temperature was to go for a walk. Okay? So the quicker thing to do is to just grab the phone and look at this app real fast. You know, I didn't mean to use the phone at all, just check the temperature and then get my clothes on and get out the door, okay? But as soon as I unlock the screen, four or five notifications like bing, 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 immediately jump in my face. Like, oh, this email arrived and that Signal message and this other thing. And okay, well, that's interesting. What did my sister say? Or, oh, okay. I was wanting to hear what that person's reply was to this email. And okay, I'll look and I look. And then afterwards, like, I turned the phone off. I didn't even check the temperature. Like, I didn't even do the one thing I wanted to do because I got distracted with these things the notifications were about. You know, so that to me is a serious vexation of smartphones, is how they're very notification centric. They're very, they know darn well that you can maximize screen time via like aggressive notifications. Yeah, that's one of the big, I would say, jumps in paradigm from like laptops or whatever to mobile is like laptops. Yeah, they have notifications, but they don't jump in your face as bad. Or at least I feel they are far more tame and don't distract me from the big thing I was trying to do, you know. But on a smartphone, they are, to me anyway, the notifications are far more intrusive and aggressive. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Well, I don't want to get too technical in this talk here, but this is the kind of thing that I feel is just worth briefly mentioning as an example about how we can hopefully try to develop a relationship with technology more, where like it is serving us and it is not we who serve the technology. You know what I mean? We got to be careful, because if we just kind of let it lead us down the garden path to satisfying our every want on there, you know, yeah, we're going to end up being very left-brain people. We're going to have very poor empathy. We're going to have very poor theory of mind. We're not really going to care much about what other people think. Our ability to communicate will be less adept, because we won't have that prosody, we won't have that modulation, et cetera, et cetera. We'll be more absent-minded. We'll lose that eureka goodness of remembering what we need to remember, even though we weren't trying to remember it. The things you need to remember will pop in your head more. Like, oh, right, I got to remember to check this, or I got to talk to that person, or I got, you know, it's those oh, right moments of, yeah, you need that from your right hemisphere to kind of cover all the duties you have, cover everything, and have a life which is a together kind of a life, like your act is together. You know what I mean? If we're very left hemisphere, we will be far less a person who has their act together. We're always going to be forgetting this and that thing, bumbling this way and forgot that, and we left a mess on the floor, and we, uh-oh, ran out of clean shirts, and oh, we didn't think ahead, and we, oh, geez, you know, we're going to be stumbling and bumbling a lot more, because that eureka goodness is not helping us. So anyway, yeah, you know, Buddhism teaches mindfulness. That, you know, this whole talk, I think, has just been various facets of what mindfulness should be doing for you when you have more right-brained development. This is all various types of mindfulness skill: mindfulness of our speech, mindfulness of our duties, mindfulness of how we live, mindfulness of how we interact with others. Okay, so maybe I'll just conclude there, and I hope this offers you a lot of food for reflection.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.